Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to James Birch. James is a curator who has promoted modern art exhibitions around the world for over 30 years. He opened his first gallery in London in 1983 and has exhibited artists including Grayson Perry, Francis Bacon, Eileen Agar and Austin Osman Spare. I'm going to be speaking to him about his new book, Bacon in Moscow. Hi James, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
So exciting. So we're here to talk about your new book, Bacon in Moscow, which is the story of trying to stage an exhibition of Francis Bacon's works in Moscow in 1988, so towards the end of the USSR, something that seems almost impossible to imagine. We don't really associate Francis Bacon with being a communist-friendly artist. How did this first come about?
Well, it was one of those strange events that I went to a party up in Notting Hill Gate. And I'd taken an artist with me who I'd been showing called David Robilliard. And at the party, I didn't know many people there, except for this one man who called Bob Chensner, who said, what was I up to? And I said, listen, I'm trying to take 10 young artists to New York, because that's where the art scene was in those days. I mean, there wasn't really much of an art scene in London. And he said, why take them to New York? Take them to Moscow. And I said, how do I do that? And he said, don't worry, ring me tomorrow and I'll get you all the details. So the next day I rang him. He said, he told me to go to the Soviet section of UNESCO in Paris, and which I did. And he said, go out and look for this man called Sergei Klokov. And I found Sergei Klokov, and I showed him 10 slides and other paraphernalia, because he didn't have computers in those days. And Klokov said, that's fine. And he told me who to write to. And lo and behold, 6 months later, when I thought everything had sort of was not going to happen, I got a telegram saying, please come to Moscow VIP, which is what I did. And I realized within about a day, there was no way that I could show that any of these artists, because there were just, there was a, like, you know, as David Billiard, Grayson Perry, and the neo-naturists. So I suddenly said, well, you know, what do you think would be interesting? And they said, well, wonderful to have Andy Warhol to break the ice for Francis Bacon. I said, well, Andy Warhol's going to be quite difficult to get, but Francis Bacon I'm known as a child. So, and plus the fact, all these artist studios I was going around, and where you had to drink sort of some vodka or Armenian brandy, the artists, I said, yeah, who's the best artist in the West do you like? And they all said Francis Bacon. So it was extraordinary. And they would bring out some sort of dog-eared magazine from a bookshelf, and lo and behold, be Francis Bacon's pictures. So I said, okay, well, I'll when I go back to London, I'll ask Francis Bacon. And that's exactly what I did. And that's how it happened.
So amazing. So if we go back in time a little bit, you had an art gallery at the Fulham end of the King's Road.
And that's correct.
Grew up in a family that was very, very involved with a lot of artists. How was it having been family friends with Francis Bacon since you grew up?
Well, I mean, he was a very odd-looking man, and he had a sort of very odd sort of stance, but he was always very nice to me. And, I mean, the other two artists that he sort of, well, stayed with, and was this Dickie Chopping, who did illustrated the covers, the dust jackets for Ian Fleming's James Bond book, and his sort of partner, Dennis Worth Miller. And so all three of them used to come over to my parents' sort of holiday home in a place called Fingringhoe near Colchester in Essex.
It's very amazing to think that you were around all of these artists when you were so young.
I know, but they were, what was so great about them? They really appreciated you and sort of looked after you, and you know, would other sort of parents would say, "Oh, go, you know, go, be quiet, go away." But Dickie and Dennis and Francis, they were always like, you know, want to have pillow fights or whatever. They were always kind of engaging in you, which is what, as a child, you love.
Yeah. So you talk about how when you first go to Moscow, you wanted to take the artist that you were working with in your gallery in Fulham. What was it like when you first get off the plane in Moscow behind the Iron Curtain at a time when many people weren't going to the USSR?
Well, it was actually one of those classic things. I mean, you can't make it up when you see those sort of spy thrillers of the 60s, 70s, 80s. You arrive in this airport on the tarmac, and it's this vast area, and you sort of see sort of little missiles aiming somewhere, and then you see sort of, you know, the odd tank, and then you sort of go in. Well, I mean, there was no one really traveling, so you go into this airport, there's hardly anybody there. What I did at that time, what I've completely forgot, I had a pair of Dr. Martin shoes that had steel toe caps. And because I was a BIP, I didn't have to go through customs. So because I had to bring all this whiskey and cigarettes for various gifts, but I did have to go through immigration. And going through immigration, suddenly the metal on my shoes alerted the alarm. The alarm went off, and clock off my connector and picked me up, was actually started to sweat because he thought that I might have had a bomb. But anyway, I got through that. And then so going through, and then you drive for miles, you get a very slow speed to eventually arrive in Moscow. And on the drive into Moscow, to the left and right, it's just endless birch trees. And behind that, who knows? So probably more missiles.
Yeah. And you first meet Glukhov in Paris, and then he becomes a very large part of the exhibition in Moscow. And he's kind of continually pushing the boundaries of what would be acceptable within the KGB in Russia at that time. What was he like as a figure?
To begin with, he was sort of a very charming figure. I mean, he was sort of larger than life. He sort of had this sort of square beard, and he wore sort of easy rider dark glasses, and he had a sort of square suit, and he was very pleased with himself because he wore Pierre Cardin, was a friend of Pierre Cardin's, I'm not quite sure how, and he also had this, he always used to say he had this sort of man bag which he bought or was given from Pierre Cardin, which was worth $1,000 anyway, and there's always a clink in the bag because he always had probably a couple of bottles of vodka hidden in there.
So a thread that runs throughout the book, perhaps this is unfair, but in Russia, you drink a lot of vodka, and in London, in Soho, you drink a lot of champagne. What was it like drinking with both the KGB and Francis Bacon?
The trouble is, in Moscow, you had to drink vodka. I mean, it was like one of those things that, if you were about to sign a deal, you'd have to have a drink afterwards, or before you signed a deal, you had to have a drink. It was compulsory. With Francis Bacon, he didn't have to drink champagne all the time, but he did love it, and so it was... I must say, to this day, I can't really drink champagne anymore because it's just, I think I probably had too much then.
What a nice problem to have, though, in a way.
That's true.
So Glukhov was a very charismatic figure, but he was also very high up in the KGB. And were you aware that you were being watched when you were in Moscow?
I had no idea. I mean, and you wouldn't, because it was such a strange cultural difference. And in a way, it was quite good to have somebody looked after. I mean, I didn't meet anybody other than who Glukhov wanted me to meet. And even if, because Marlboro cigarettes were a currency, you could hold out a packet of Marlboro cigarettes and you could get a taxi. So having a packet of Marlboro cigarettes, the Russians loved American tobacco because otherwise they had just a Russian tobacco, which really stank. And so in that sense...
But yeah, you met people through giving them cigarettes.
Yeah, and Glukhov would immediately dismiss them and say, go away, or whatever he said. So that's why I never met anybody other than who I was allowed to meet.
Yeah, and we kind of think of the late 1980s, just before the fall of the Berlin Wall, in a way, as a period of, you know, glasnost, everything opening up. But perhaps it wasn't. I mean, that's the benefit of retrospect, isn't it? At the time, it didn't feel inevitable that things were going to open up and change that dramatically.
No, because it was still very slow in Moscow. I mean, the first time I went, which was 1986, there was still, you know, big hammer and sickle posters or murals on the walls. And only really when going back again in 88, I noticed that those posters and murals had been painted out. And now saying, do not drink vodka, or just try and stop vodka. Because then Gorbachev realised he had a real problem with them. Alcoholism in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, it's very sad. So if we talk about the actual difficulties of staging the exhibition, Francis Bacon's gallery in London was the Marlborough Gallery. And
correct,
there was difficulties with working out who was going to fund the exhibition in Moscow because Russia didn't have the money to pay for it. The British Arts Council perhaps suggested they might end up funding part of it and then didn't. What was that like? What was the stress of the kind of admin of organising such a difficult exhibition?
Well, I mean, that, in a sense, that was really more to up to his gallery than me. I mean, and to the British Council for which they were in with the gallery, with the Marble Gallery. So it was quite stressful because I it was incredibly expensive exhibition to mount. If you think to take all these, well, what are 44 paintings to Russia, was kind of very difficult. And so that was the problem.
Yeah, and I imagine a lot of their owners felt reluctant to surrender them to travel to Moscow with the insurance and everything.
Well, exactly. And because also don't forget, Russia was still a rogue country and it was still, the Cold War and still the enemy.
Yeah, yeah. And so what was it like finding an exhibition space itself in Moscow to host the exhibition in?
Well, at the time, there was an exhibition space which rather reminded me of the Haywood Gallery, and it was sort of under renovation. So in fact, I mean, so it was great space and big high ceilings, lots of light. So that was a good space. The Central House of Artists, it was called.
Yeah. And you met quite a different cast of characters when you were over in Russia. So one of them was Elena, who eventually came back to the UK with you. And she was high up in fashion in Russia. What was she like? Could you tell us a bit more about her?
Well, she was rather amazing. Well, amazing looking and a rather amazing person. I mean, when I first met her, I did meet her in Paris with Sergei Klokov. And what I found extraordinary was, so, in a sort of little French bistro, we had a start and then a main course and then a pudding and coffee and whatever. And in between courses, Elena would change her outfit. And I thought, maybe this is a Russian cultural thing. I just didn't get it. But in fact, years later, I found out, because I was from the West, she thought I might know somebody in fashion. So if she changed her fashion, her costumes, I might be able to help her. Which was quite sweet in a way, but that's because they were so desperate to find anybody that could actually do something for them. And so, Klokov said, she's washed up here as high priestess of fashion. So, it'd be great if I could invite her to London. And in those days, you'd have to get married to somebody. But in fact, because of Perestroika and Glasnost, I could invite her out as long as I was responsible for her, which is exactly what I did.
Yeah. And what was the relationship like? I don't want to pry, but it sounds, at the end of the book, there's some implication that she might have been reporting to the KGB on your movements as well.
Well, see, that was rather shocking because I had no idea. Only really after the breakdown of the Soviet Union, and this was probably about 94, 95, this friend of mine, Misha Mahave, who also helped with the exhibition, he said, oh, James, do you want to buy your KGB files? I said, what? He said, yes, they were like 2,000 pages long. I went, really? I said, but where's all the information coming from? He said, oh, Elena. I said, what? Anyway, so, and I was thinking, well, what kind of information could Elena report back? I had two boiled eggs for breakfast. What? I mean, so I didn't buy these KGB files. Now it's impossible to get. I tried again, and I just can't get them.
Yeah, it'd be amazing to read what she said, though. Yeah.
I know, it'd be probably so boring. Or maybe she made it up. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe she did make it up. So there, it wasn't just the admin difficulties of staging an exhibition of Francis Bacon's works in Moscow. He was also quite a difficult man in many ways to deal with the publicity side of. So there are a couple of books that he stopped the publication of just before they were meant to go out. And there was always a worry that A, Russia might stop the exhibition, or Francis Bacon himself might prevent it. How did it eventually end up happening? Did that feel impossible in a way?
The amazing thing actually with socialist or communist countries, once it's written in stone, they're not going to change it unless the war happens. So from that angle, that was always going to happen from the Russian side. But from France's side, I mean, he could be very difficult and quite controlling in a sense that he could change his mind at any given moment. And luckily, he didn't. I mean, he was really excited by this exhibition, and to such an extent that he went out and bought himself a Sony Walkman and some Russian cassettes so he could learn Russian. And so from that, and when I went to pick up his companion John Edwards from his from Rees Mews, where he lived, to take him on the plane to British Airways for Moscow for the opening, Francis had his bag packed, really ready to go. But I didn't know then that he could have come on the plane, but and a visa would have been issued for him immediately when he arrived in Moscow. But I didn't know that information, so he didn't come, sadly.
Yeah, and he blamed his asthma for not being able to travel. But was that the real reason?
That's right.
Do you think there was another reason he didn't go to Moscow? Or,
well, he also didn't. I mean, what he really wanted to do was come to Moscow, go to the opening, and then catch a train to what was then Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, and go and see the Rembrandt in the Hermitage. But I think he sort of drinks with the ambassador and whoever, and that's what Francis really didn't want to do. And he was sort of quite annoyed by that. So that might be another reason he didn't want to come.
Yeah, yeah. So at the end of the book, the exhibition is staged in Moscow and it does do very well. You quote all of these people talking about why they really appreciate Francis Bacon. Why do you think Bacon's paintings, because at the beginning of the book, you talk about how they kind of appeal to people in a post-Holocaust, post-World War II sense. Why do you think they appeal to people in the USSR?
Well, I think it's because it's very much, I mean, I'm afraid to say their art that they had then was pretty boring, stagnant copies that was so old-fashioned. That so to have Francis Bacon's work, which was sort of quite vivid, brutal, which is pretty much like the same system there, was actually quite, you know, in itself was brutal. It's amazing that, and that's why I think quite a lot of Russians really appreciated and enjoyed his work. Well, there's sort of that existential feel that he gave. So that's why I think, and I said what was remarkable was there's one man who was looking at a Francis Bacon painting for 4.5 hours. I mean, he was just absorbing some culture from the West. I mean, and I just thought that was fantastic.
Do you know which painting it was?
It was the, I think it's called The Road to Uzès. It's of sort of Vincent van Gogh. Going along, I mean, it might be called figure number 4, but anyway, it's certainly Vincent van Gogh on the road to Uzès in France.
Yeah. Have you been to see the Bacon exhibition at the Royal Academy at the moment?
No, I haven't yet. I've seen the catalogue, but I haven't seen the exhibition. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
I have seen it, but I just wonder if anyone who is there appreciates it as much as the people who appreciated it in Moscow in 1988, yeah.
Oh, well, that'd be an interesting thing to find out, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, go around asking them. So you took the idea of staging exhibitions in other communist countries on with the rest of your career, and you took an exhibition of Gilbert and George to Beijing and Shanghai in China. You didn't really talk about that much in the book, but I just wanted to ask what that was like. Was it more difficult interacting with the Chinese Communist Party than the USSR?
Well, the same after... the Francis Bacon exhibition, after the opening, the next day I proposed Gilbert George for Russia. And so they had an exhibition in Russia, and that was very good. And then Gilbert George said to me, well, we'd love to have an exhibition in China. So I said, okay. And it's just one of those many things where I went to see somebody in Dublin who told me who to get in contact with the Chinese embassy in London. And that's exactly what I did. And lo and behold, the Chinese embassy kind of got Gilbert George's work. And then they had an exhibition in Beijing, I think it was 1993, and then in Shanghai. And that's another adventure.
Another book?
And maybe another book.
Yeah. Did you feel more watched or observed in China? Did you go to the exhibition in China?
Oh, you said, oh, no, I was there. I was actually in China for 3 months, which is quite a long time to be in a place and to be in a hotel for 3 months. That's quite exhausting in itself. Were we watched? Probably, but you wouldn't know it. But there's so many people around. And occasionally somebody would say, what are you doing? Or who are you? Are you a tourist? Are you a businessman? But I mean, it was people don't quite understand that China looked quite open. It was still quite closed down, and it was still practically one of those situations where a pencil or a digital watch would be a great privileged present to somebody.
Yeah, and you also tried to organise an exhibition in North Korea with the DPKD, but that didn't end up happening. What was the difficulty there?
Well, the difficulty there was the sanctions on North Korea. And when you say sanctions, there was absolutely nothing there. I had to bring Black and Decker drill, nails, you name it. And the only thing that weren't in the sanctions was blue tack and a mop. And otherwise, everything else was sanctioned. And if I took anything else, like a stepladder, that's breaking the sanctions, I'd probably end up in prison in the States somewhere. So it didn't happen. I mean, the North Koreans were fine about it, and they really wanted something to happen. But it's the, it's the West that stopped it.
Yeah. So the thread that runs through all of these exhibitions and the attempted exhibition in North Korea is a sense that, in a way, art and Western art of a kind of, there's a power to taking it to countries which have more controlled or oppressed systems. Is that something that you believe in still, do you think?
Well, I think that what shook me was seeing that man looking at a Francis Bacon painting for 4.5 hours. I really realized just the clink of light could change the whole perception. And I thought with China and certainly with North Korea, again, probably China's different now, but certainly North Korea, the art is quite stagnant, rather similar to what the Russian painting was in the 80s when I saw it.
Yeah, and you were given a painting from Russia, weren't you? Do you still have it?
I still have it. It's called Moscow Nights. And it's quite funny that, in a sense, that Sergei Klokov is determined to give me this painting from an artist, which I have. And he, lo and behold, got a Francis Bacon painting. So, in a sense, this picture has the value of Francis Bacon painting, but not.
Yeah, I think Klokov won that one. You were offered a Francis Bacon at one point, weren't you? But you didn't end up having it.
No, because his companion, John Edwards, said that I didn't need a Francis Bacon painting when Francis offered me one, which was... it's very sad, and I was too shy to say, oh yes, I'd love to have one.
Yeah, it's amazing. And are you planning to write another book, do you think, about other exhibitions? Or
I mean at the moment it's going so well, the Bacon in Moscow book, that I haven't time to think straight, really.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.